Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report online at schachterenergyreport.ca. He's speaking to us from Calgary. Welcome back to the show, Joseph.
It's good to be back with you, Jim.
Joseph, you just had your energy conference. How did that go?
Oh, this was our best one yet. We had 45 companies from the energy, both the conventional energy and the emerging energy, be it critical minerals or clean tech, up from 34 last year. So big change there. About 700 people, up from 540 or 560 the year before. The weather was very nice. We didn't have snow like we did in 22. And the premier came and opened the conference, and with the announcement from the Supreme Court of Canada that a lot of the issues with that the feds were trying to push through were on provincial rights and not federal rights, you had the premier in a very good mood to be happy about that, and then of course the issue with the feds isn't going to go away. You've already seen the environment minister say they'll just change the wording of the law or change the legislation around and try again. But that'll mean another 6 years, going through the courts to the Supreme Court. So, hopefully by then, maybe we don't have the Liberal government in power, and more rational heads can be in place, to do what's right, to meet the long-term climate goals. But, my comment always is, whatever we do in Canada doesn't matter. If China and India do not get rid of the coal-fired industries for electricity, then whatever we do doesn't matter in terms of global emissions. And right now we're seeing more and more coal plants coming because, they're trying to do solar and wind. They all want EVs and they're working on that, but they're still using a lot more electricity. And of course, if you want EVs, you need electricity too, and charging stations. So, the whole issue here, is really one where, until we see major progress from India and China, the global benefits are not going to be there.
Well, in India, they still burn a tremendous amount of cow dung for energy. How do you control that?
Well, when people are poor and they don't have alternative, for cooking and for and using, the cow dung for the agricultural side, you really don't have any, choice. As their economy industrializes, just like we saw with China, a lot of people leaving rural China to go to urban China. As that situation now goes to what's becoming the largest population country in the world, they're going to start at some point seeing more migration into the big cities, and I think that's going to be something that will change maybe that use, because let's say the farmers will be more productive, make more income, and maybe be able to be able to use fertilizers and not need the dung, but the dung will still be used in the poorest of regions simply because the economics are attractive for the local population.
Has Canada missed the boat when it comes to LNG?
No, you've got LNG Canada coming on at the end of 24, early 25. There's four or five other projects in the queue, supported by First Nations, supported now by the BC government. We missed, two decades here, or at least a decade, because of the infighting and not getting everybody on the same page. We now have that. And so while the U.S. is right now the largest LNG exporter, and they were a non-event years ago, is Qatar and Australia. Now we're seeing them as number one. And they're the number one energy producer, oil and natural gas, and liquids producer in the world. So we're now seeing, the potential here, for Canada by the end of the decade to have 4, 5, 6 plants, depending upon the approval process and the financial arrangement, and the takeaway arrangement. But remember, we have such a big benefit. Going from the Gulf of Mexico, you've got to go through the Panama Canal for the U.S. and then off to the Asian markets. They have an advantage to the European markets, of course, which, of course, with Russia now not able to sell gas to Germany and other countries in Europe, France, etc., that's a benefit for the U.S. Gulf Coast. But to the Asian markets, to South Korea, Japan, China, Vietnam, all those countries, we have the logistics are shorter to take natural gas from the west coast of Canada to those countries, shipping costs lower. I think we have a built-in advantage, and I think that's something that I think we're beginning to exploit, even though we were asleep at the switch for over a decade.
Do you think Canada needs to improve relations with China and India to secure those markets, or are they just going to be there because of their population demands?
Well, right now, I think the federal government has problems with India because of the killing of the Sikh leader in your province. But these things change over time. Right now, India has cut off visas for people traveling to India. We had the problem with China with a couple Canadians that were incarcerated. These political things come and go, a change in leadership in Ottawa, a new government, if it's hopefully conservative, with Poilievre, but even if it's a new liberal leader, that can change the dynamic as well, simply because of the individuals that are involved are no longer, fighting each other, and diplomats can get in there and try to solve, the day-to-day challenges that every, diplomacy has in the normal course of things.
Do you think Chrystia Freeland, who's the Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister, would be a little more sympathetic to the energy sector because she's from my hometown of Peace River, Alberta?
Well, I think she's, like anything, population matters. So Ontario and Quebec are where the population centers are and the political dynamic is. So, while she may be willing to listen more and not be so dogmatic on her high horse or on the soapbox like Trudeau is, I think that she'll have to take that into account. She's one that's pushed, the free trade deals to get Mexico, U.S. Together. So she knows the dynamics of the climate issue in each of the other two countries. She's been, very astute and very involved in what's going on in Europe with Ukraine. So, I think, we may have, if she does get the mantle from the Liberal Party to be the next leader of the party and run in the next election, we would see a less escalation and less tension on the political side because I think she is a lot smoother and less confrontational leader.
And perhaps, unlike our current prime minister, would understand monetary policy.
Well, she's still running some obscene deficits, but again, the whole world is. U.S. numbers, 1.7, 1.8 trillion. The U.S. interest is now going to be $1 trillion, and that's rising because, of course, the rollovers of cheaper debt plus the large deficits, and that compares to, what, $4.5 trillion of revenue that the U.S. brings in. So 23% heading higher of U.S. revenues are being used for interest coverage. That's unsustainable. We at least, have lower numbers than the U.S., but we still have big deficit numbers. But with the economy being so strong, revenues coming in from the energy industry, revenues coming in from GST, revenues from payroll taxes are going to help the feds get their financial position in better order. I don't know if we'll see a surplus in the next few years, but the deficits will be trending down unless we see another recession or some problem in the system. But right now, you know, the dynamics are starting to look in favor of the federal government.
Now, I think the Canadian government claims it's been running a surplus the last few months, or is that just a trick of some kind of bookkeeping deal?
It could be seasonal accounting, you know, when companies pay their taxes. There are months, you know, like when there is surpluses historically, you know, like tax payment, you know, periods like March, April, you know, when people pay their taxes if they owe any. So those could be surplus months, but then, you know, you get into other months and then they could be big deficits. So I'm not an expert on that and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think that that's normal, just like the cash flows, you know, just like when you get paid that day, the day you get paid, you got your bank account's good. And then, of course, you got to pay rent or house mortgage or whatever, and then that number comes down. So, you know, it's we all have it in our personal lives. Government has it in their lives.
Yeah, CTV said the Canadian government posted a surplus of $1.5 billion in the first 2 months of the fiscal year. So that's at least a positive move there, but who knows what's being cut, veterans or something like that, to make up that money. Now, with China's economy slowing down because of their real estate crisis, what does that do to the global oil market?
Well, you know, China, you know, consumes about 15 million barrels a day. They produce 4 million. They've been doing that for 30 or 40 years. They haven't been able to grow that 4 million barrels a day of production. So if there's a million or two of weaker demand, that can have an impact on the price of crude. They did take advantage of the lower prices when we were in the 60s to build up their strategic reserve, which they've done. So right now, I think that, you know, their consumption is weak because of consumer spending. They are trying to, you know, do things to help the real estate industry. They're, you know, that new Huawei phone, you know, which is using the, you know, the seven, whatever the, you know, the nano, whatever it is that they're doing, is showing that they can compete against Apple, and Apple is losing business in China. The other thing, of course, is we're seeing EV sales slow down in China because consumer spending is tight, and, you know, charging stations, NIO, has got a thing where you can drive your car up and they'll just exchange the battery while you're having a tea or a coffee. So, you know, they are being creative in trying to get people to switch, which, of course, you know, helps out on the environmental, you know, the exhausts. But it is an issue, just the whole thing of weaker consumer spending. Remember, the wealth in China is not in the stock market like it is in Canada and the States. It's, you know, real estate is a big part of it in both countries, Canada and the States. But in China, people would buy multiple apartment buildings, apartment units, and that was their savings because, you know, you put a large down payment, the building got built, you found some tenants, you know, you saved up more, bought another one. Not to live in, but to rent out or to have as a speculative thing. And for many, many years, that was a very successful way of doing it. And now, of course, that's not. You know, we've seen articles in the Globe and Mail on the weekend where they talk about the higher interest rates impacting, you know, people who live in homes and what they're doing, downsizing. Others, they showed, you know, speculators or investors who had multiple properties, be it office buildings or apartment buildings in Toronto, and some of them have had to sell part of their portfolios because they couldn't. There was negative cash flows on many of them, and then to keep what they could, they had to sell some to stave off the loss of more.
Of course, trouble in the Middle East, that's usually a sign that oil prices are about to go up. Is that happening this time?
Yeah, we were $82 before the October 7th invasion by Hamas and the massacres and the taking of hostages. We're now, you know, in the 88, 89 range. So we've had a, you know, $5-6 bounce in the price. fundamentally that, you know, the price of oil should be below 80, but we now have maybe a $10 war premium in there because of what's going on in the Middle East and the riots and the protests that are occurring all around the world against Israel for the bombing that occurred at that hospital in Gaza City. Again, the Americans are saying that the evidence shows that it was an errant Islamic Jihad missile that was being fired at Israel, but there was no bomb damage, like they're saying from the Hamas side. They're saying that it was an Israeli jet fighter that did it with a bomb, but there's no big crater that you would normally see if something like that happened. And then there's also intelligence from drones that show that it was from the Islamic Jihad. So the evidence is there, saying that it wasn't Israel's fault for this, massive casualty count, which, again, there's question if the casualties were as big as Hamas noted. But the damage is done, you know, in terms of the political view that we have, Israel's the bad guy here, and people are forgetting what happened on October 7th because of the longstanding problems that have been impacted the Palestinians leaving in Gaza, where there's 2.1, 2.2 million people, where 30,000 Hamas militants are running the roost there, and it's like it's like the gangs in Mexico running towns and cities, and of course the population can't get rid of them. So it's a pretty sad situation for the people in that area, and at some point I think we will see, aid go into southern Gaza. The Americans are working on that with Egypt, but they want to make sure it's only food, medicine and water. I think at some point Israel will go in there to remove the Hamas militants, and that's going to be a very ugly phase of war, which we always hear about, and with the news people being embedded in both sides, both in Israel and in Gaza, it's front and center with all of us. When we turn on the news on the TV or radio, we hear more and more about, the ugliness of war.
Well, everybody's got a camera now. Everybody has a film camera in their phone. So, yeah, every little horror will be revealed. And the thing is, the sad thing is, we still don't learn from it. As no. That wars go in cycles, Eric Haddock, friend of the show, points out, in the Middle East, the violence cycle is 17 years.
Yeah, and we've seen others talk about the war cycle, some of these long-term forecasters. And, of course, Ukraine, now you have this, maybe it's Taiwan next. I think the thing to watch is what happens when the ground offensive starts in North Gaza, if Hezbollah starts a second front. And does Syria get involved, as all the Iranian proxies get involved? That would mean that it's becoming a more, a more worldwide situation, and of course more casualties. And that's why I think the U.S. has those two carrier groups in there, so that Israel, if their Iron Dome system, which has worked effectively in the south, they don't have enough in the north, then the American jet fighters and the American guided missile boats that are supporting the carrier would be able to shoot them down before they attack the major centers, because the Hezbollah has more of the guided missiles. They have 130,000, and Hezbollah has, supposedly 100,000, soldiers versus the Hamas having 30,000 militias.
Now, how would the world's oil supply hold out if the Middle East starts to really cook?
Well, the key thing is America, if Iran puts their proxies into the war in the north, Hezbollah, Syria, and, they move, forces in from Yemen and other places, and Iranian militant, militias go in as well, then, the U.S. may be forced to sanction Iran more and even blockade their shipments of oil, which cannot go, those that don't go by pipeline to China. And so that could make, prices go north of 100, maybe even back to the prices we saw when Russia invaded Ukraine. But I don't think that's a long-term sustainable thing at this point. I think $130 oil would really hit economies around the world. Consumption would come off, and things would balance out again. Right now I don't see, Saudi Arabia, and other big producers, Kuwait, UAE, really wanting to be part of a cutoff of the oil supplies to the world, knowing, how precarious economies are, and knowing that, Hamas did start this, and that Hamas, being backed by Iran, a lot of these countries are not real fans of Iran either, the old Sunni Shia issue. I think the risk is very low of a major country deliberately cutting off crude oil because of what's going on there. But I think, if it escalates to the point where Iran is directly involved, then America could have to blockade Iran, and that would change the dynamic. I don't see that happening, though. I don't think Iran is that suicidal, because the population there are not really happy with the government, with the Mullah government. If they do something like this, you could see protests in the streets again in Iran, and then with an American blockade cutting off supplies of consumer goods and others, that could really impact it, and you may even see at some point the government becomes in jeopardy of staying in power.
We'll have more with Joseph Schachter right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Joseph Schachter. Joseph, what's going on with Venezuela?
Well, President Biden seems to have gotten Maduro and his dictatorship to agree to more open elections, that he doesn't arrest and put in jail opposition leaders, that there will be international observers there for the election. So he's now removed sanctions on the oil for a number of months to just see if this process works out. In the month of September, Venezuela produced 733,000 BOEs a day or barrels a day of oil. At one point, going back a couple decades ago, they were producing, before Chavez got in power, they were producing 4 million barrels a day. So and this is heavy oil in the Orinoco Basin, and that is bigger than the oil sands in Canada. So could they increase production? One of the companies in there, Chevron, went from nothing to 135,000 this year. They're talking about raising production on their own to 200,000 next year. And if more and more of the companies that had oil assets in the country, in Venezuela, when the government nationalized everything, the government gives them back to them. The example of Kuwait, after all the blowing up of all the surface and, stuff that Saddam Hussein did when he was pushed out of Kuwait, he destroyed all the infrastructure there. It was a year or so later that Kuwait's production was back to full production as it was before the war. So my view is that if American technology and sanctions are removed and the workers are able to come back and work, and the Chavez government or the Maduro government, doesn't cause any more problems, I think we could see a 1 or 2 million barrel increase over the next couple of years of heavy oil being produced, and that would then find markets. Right now it goes to China and Cuba, but it could find markets in the U.S. as well, because the Gulf Coast refineries can handle the heavies. And, of course, a lot of the companies that would be coming back own the refineries on the Gulf Coast, so the distance to bring Venezuelan crude to the U.S. would be cheaper than by pipeline from Canada. So I think that's an issue for our oil sands producers here in Canada. And I think that's why everybody's looking forward to the TMX pipeline coming on, in case we lose volumes into the Gulf Coast because of Venezuela being able to produce more oil. And I think that's an issue to me that would mean that the oil sands production will be capped after they After the production goes into the TMX pipeline, with the expansion there, 560,000 BOEs a day, or barrels a day, sorry. Once that happens, I think we're at peak export capacity, and I think over time, the only to you know like companies like Suncor and Cenovus that have refineries in the United States that can take their heavy oil, anyone who was planning to ship down to the Gulf Coast to refineries that were not you know captive or owned by the same company, that's where the volumes are going to go down. And I think that's going to be a negative to the production profile, the optimistic production profile, or oil sands that that many of the optimists on that sector in Canada believe. I'm in the negative camp on that. I think that this Venezuelan issue is a significant one. And remember, we gained 3-4 million barrels into the U.S. Gulf Coast because of Venezuela and Mexico losing their capacities to produce heavies. And so now... We gained that for the last number of years. We may lose some of that volume, you know, in the period, you know, to come. You know, we've been a big beneficiary of it, and you know, the numbers just say that that's going to change. You know, if you look at Canada's production this year, in the third quarter, it's 5.7 million barrels, and going next year, once we have TMX on, we should be over 6 million barrels, but I think that we could lose maybe a million of that in the years ahead if the Venezuelan situation does occur as I expect it to if Maduro keeps his word and the elections are fair and somewhat free in the second half of 2024 when the next election cycle kicks in for the presidency there.
How healthy is the Canadian petroleum sector?
Oh, it's you know, we're going to see cash flows come out. You know, the company should start reporting in the next week or two. The numbers will be lower than Q3 of last year because the commodity price is lower. You know, I think, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think we're going to see. Remember, last year you had war premium prices, and we don't have those right now. Because of, you know, what was going on what was going on in Ukraine. So I think we're going to see, comparisons that are net, that production might be same or up a little bit, but cash flows will be lower because commodity prices are lower, both for oil and natural gas. So the comparisons will be negative, and we'll see how the market reacts to that.
How is the Alberta labor front doing? Are they still short petroleum workers?
No, you know, for number one, the drilling rig count has come down, and that is a big issue. You know, with the rig count is, you know, is an important part for the industry, and the rig count has been coming down for the last number of months, and I think that that is continuing. So if we see, so the labor market there is a little looser, you know, there's no real big construction projects in Fort Mac right now. You can see a lot of cranes in downtown Calgary and Edmonton where they're building a lot of apartment buildings, because we've had significant migration into the province, the highest, I think, in Canada. You know, there's a big expansion in technology and healthcare and, you know, the universities, government's hiring more. Alberta's been very fortunate that we're seeing that migration, and the wealth effect is coming. The budget surpluses are here, not like the Fed's in the negative count. And you know, the house prices have strengthened, and we're not anywhere near where we were in, you know, 80, 81 when we had real crazy prices. But prices are lifting here. The cost of ownership is problematic, just like it is in Vancouver or Toronto, if you don't have the money for a down payment, given the interest rate, significant interest rate lift that we've seen over the last year.
Joseph, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
I'd keep an eye on the U.S. stock market. My concern there is that, you know, with these high interest rates, we may start seeing corporate profits being impacted. So far, consumer spending, retail spending has been good. Housing has been impacted. But I think we're going to see that, people have been, we've seen credit card usage at record highs. We're seeing defaults now starting to happen on auto loans. So I think there's some problems in the U.S. economy. And if their economy starts getting hit, we have a number of sectors in the U.S. that are very inflated on the stock price side, AI stocks, the FANGs and others, that if we start seeing a meltdown, 32,600 on the Dow or 4,295 on the S&P 500, it closes below those numbers, I think could cause a significant correction in the general stock market, and that would bring down energy securities. And I think we'll be sometime in Q4, we are going to see another great buying opportunity like we did in March. If you remember when you and I were talking then, I was saying the stocks in the energy sector were table-pounding buys, and we added two times seven names each time to our buy list. Right now we have kept the same level of names, but I think that we will probably have another buy list sometime later, this quarter, but it'll be because of a general stock market dragging down the high beta sectors, and energy is always a high beta sector.
Joseph, thank you so much for chatting with us.
My pleasure as always, Jim.
My guest has been Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report, online at schachterenergyreport.ca. If you have any questions for Joseph or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.